Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to this week's show, brought to you by the fine folks at Tenable Network Security and hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, as always. In our first bit of self-congratulatory news, Risky Business has been highly commended in the Media Connect IT Journalist Awards a couple of weeks ago. We were entered in the Best Multimedia Reporting category, which was won by the girls and guys at Good Game, the ABC weekly television show about gaming. But Risky Business and CIO Online shared the honours for second place in a hotly contested field. And moving on, and today we're talking to Jeremiah Grossman about cross-site request forgery, or CSRF. Jeremiah of White Hat Security in the US was the first ever guest on Risky Business way back in February 2007. Back then, he was telling us it was just a matter of time before the bad guys started exploiting CSRF. And well, he's come back to give us the bad news. The bad guys have started exploiting CSRF. So there you go. We'll be hearing from him in a bit. And that's our feature interview for this week. In this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by the founder and CTO of Tenable Network Security, Ron Gula. Ron's a bit of an InfoSec legend. He wrote the Dragon Intrusion Detection System way back when, before selling it and his company Network Security Wizards to Interasys Networks for God knows how much moolah. Now, a lot of people know that Tenable is big in vulnerability scanning through its ownership of Nessus, but they've also made some big moves into security information event management, and Ron will be along later to discuss that. But first, as always, it's time for a check of the week's headlines, which I can tell is going to turn into a bit of a rant, but yes, it's time for a check of the week's headlines with ZDNet Australia's Mania Katardia. And Mania, if you were to believe everything you were going to read in the Sydney Morning Herald, apparently every single employer in the country is about to start reading everyone's emails in the interests of national security.
Yeah, well, none of us are safe. Our friend Facebook requests, all sorts of emails are all going to be read by our bosses because they're really, really interested in that kind of stuff, and it'll help them fight terrorism.
Yeah, well, this is kind of how it was reported by the Sydney Morning Herald. Here's the opening paragraph. Companies will be able to intercept the emails and internet communications of their employees without their consent under new laws being considered by the federal government to protect the nation's critical infrastructure from a cyber attack.
It's quite funny, really, isn't it?
Well, what's funny about this is that employers in most states, I believe in Australia, already have the power to intercept your communications without your consent as long as they place a warning at the login prompt. I know that's the case in New South Wales under the Workplace Surveillance Act. So,
right.
A, this isn't news.
And they've been able to do that for quite a while, haven't they? I know that,
yes.
That they also have, it's the same with instant messengers as well. You know, they can monitor that. And
they can monitor IM, yeah. Web use. They can even put a video camera, like, on you. As long as there's signs up and constant reminders that you're under surveillance. It's covered in the same act.
Yeah.
So, A, this isn't really big news. But B, really, it's a... It's a modification to the Telecommunications Interceptions Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is going to allow companies to actually do malware filtering, because at the moment, the way the Act is structured, even doing like virus filtering at the gateway, I believe, is considered an interception of a telecommunication. So it's illegal.
I heard that there was some sort of court case about this a little while back, wasn't there?
Oh, look, I didn't hear anything about that. But, I mean, basically what they're trying to do is introduce some certainty into the Act. And, you know, really, like, there are some security implications here. Like, if you're running a mail gateway that's quarantining stuff with dodgy attachments, you know, wouldn't you like to let your security team be able to manually inspect those quarantined emails?
And do you need to get a permission from your employees before you can do that?
Well, at the moment, it's all a little bit ambiguous. I don't think anyone really knows. And that's kind of the problem. And I think that's what our Attorney General was referring to. But of course, his comments along the lines of, we're going to amend the Telecommunications Act so that companies can, you know, look after malware. Here's the exact quotes from Robert McClellan, the Federal Attorney General. He said, at least 90% of networks exist outside of government, but there's no powers for corporate network supervisors to intercept such communications unless they have specific authority from the employee.
No, I think that makes it pretty clear.
Okay, and he continues, it's unquestionable that it's necessary from time to time for network supervisors to open emails addressed to people to identify viruses and the like. There needs to be protocols and guidelines developed so companies can protect their own networks. It will need new legislation. So from those fairly sensible comments, we've got all these headlines about how bosses are going to start spying on employees and it's Big Brother stomping on the head of the proletariat and, you know, it's very not
great
cool.
In this story, like, the the quotes you just read are the actual last four paragraphs of the story.
Well, yeah, yeah, of the last four paragraphs of the story that I managed to, you know, cut and send to you. I mean, there's more to it, but the fact is, yeah, it was a complete, utter beat up. And then, you know, and this is really what we're focusing on today, Munir, in our news segment, is the beat up continued over at IDG, at Computer World Online, where Darren Pawley wrote that sweeping reforms will make it easier than ever for law enforcement to intercept communications if amendments to the Telecommunications Act are agreed upon by a Senate Standing Committee. Now, Computer World gave the headline to this piece of concerns raised as government demands universal wiretapping.
Yes.
I mean, would you say that that's alarmist?
I'd say it's a little bit, yes.
Now, really, this is a separate amendment that Darren's writing about here, which says the federal government is pushing a bill to force all telecommunications providers to facilitate lawful data interception across fixed and mobile telephone systems, voice over internet protocol, instant messaging and chat room discussions. Now, mate, I hate to tell you this, but this has been the case for a very long time. If you're an internet carriage provider, or if you're a telco, you need to offer an interception capability to law enforcement. And if they present you with a warrant, you've got to be able to give them a tap. So all they're trying to do is extend that to voice over IP, because there's all these voice over IP protocols out there. But the fact is, the cops are still going to need signed warrants from a judge before they can tap your voice over IP.
Now, hang on, this is really, really strange. Are you telling me that the government's trying to do something good and the papers are bashing them?
Well, the government's just trying to do what it's always done, but with the new technologies, and everyone's turning it into this whole thing like Big Brother's out to, you know, give you an anal probe.
No, from the quotes that we've heard there, it just shows that they're looking at emails, there's an actual security angle to this, and nobody seems to have cottoned onto that too much.
Well, no, but this is the separate amendment now that we're talking about, the Computer World's talking about, which is that voice over IP providers are going to have to provide an interception capability, so if some drug kingpin or whatever, you know, I mean, even getting an interception warrant in Australia is really hard, right? So you've got to basically have, I'm pretty sure you need a prima facie case against someone before you can even get a warrant to tap their calls. So, you know, I don't know, it just seems a bit odd. But then Computer World has taken that proposed amendment and then in the same story mentioned the other one from the Sydney Morning Herald story and saying that private organisations will be handed quasi-police powers
under separate
government plans announced on Monday. So
that's a great line, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, combine this today, if you notice, we're recording this, of course, on Monday. If you go to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald online and you look at their technology section, there is a headline there currently, Munir, that I'm just going to look up, next to a picture of a mushroom cloud, which says, in cyberspace, they can't hear you scream. And the subheadline is, a keyboard is all terrorists need in their quest to deliver mass chaos and destruction. Now, I'm sorry I've gone off on a bit of a rant here, but have you noticed that the coverage of information security and national security as it relates to information security in the last 10 days has just been completely bloody mental?
You don't seem too happy with this at all.
No, I'm not. I'm not. It gives us other journos, us honest journos, a bloody bad name when everyone's running around beating it up. Don't you agree?
No, I agree with you. Yes, it's true.
That's all you got to say?
I'm just worried you're going to pull out another story from us now and take the piss out.
No, you guys didn't jump on the bandwagon. I mean,
okay.
Seems okay. Not that I found, anyway. I think you ran something kind of along the lines of the SMH piece, but, you know, follow the leader. It was their beat up.
Okay.
If you don't jump on the beat up bandwagon, you're kind of in trouble. You know that. But don't you think this is just appalling that people are taking these very sensible little legislative tweaks and turning them into alarmist beat-ups?
You know what I think? I think it's actual surprise that the government is saying something sensible and people can't quite take that in and think, no, it must be a load of rubbish, and then taking the other angle to it.
Yeah, I guess. But then again, it's good to have people being concerned over civil liberties angles. But even Electronic Frontiers Australia are like, dude, what the fuck? You know, they're posting stuff online saying, this really isn't a big deal. And they're the ones who are supposed to be jumping up and down and screaming the hardest.
If they are actually for this, then I'm really, really surprised. That's really scary.
Well, what's funny is initially Dale Clapperton, who's their resident mouthpiece, you know, was quoted saying, oh, this is terrible, blah, 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 blah. And then I think he realised he'd been sort of, you know, sucked into the beat-up vortex.
Right.
And they issued a statement on their website saying that they looked forward to working with the Attorney General and that this is, you know, maybe a legislative reform that's needed and blah, 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 blah. But anyway, the press has let us down. It's a bunch of big beat-ups everywhere. So,
okay. But at least you guys heard the truth here.
That's right, man. We're the last outpost of honest media. Now, into regular security news now, and PayPal is considering blocking insecure browsers.
Yeah, that's right. They've launched a paper, which is a practical approach to managing phishing. And they say there's no silver bullet to prevent fraudsters. But, you know, if there's dodgy browsers, then they could block them.
So what
which one do you think they're talking about?
Well, they're talking about, I know Safari is one of them.
Yep.
I know also embedded browsers, like the browser on the Nintendo Wii.
Oh, right.
I think Opera, maybe. But it's all about whether or not they've got phishing protection and things like that. So, you know, your IE and your Firefox are going to be safe if they're up-to-date versions and whatever. But it's an interesting idea, isn't it, really? Like blocking people's transactions based on whether or not they're using a security feature-packed end-user agent.
But, I mean, does this mean, you know, if there's a known flaw in IE or in Firefox or something that hasn't been patched yet, that they're going to block it until it is?
I don't think they'd go quite that far, but still, it's an interesting idea, and I wonder if we're going to see banks and things like that saying, I'm sorry, you're using, you know, Internet Explorer version 2. So that's deemed by us to be insecure and piss off.
Yeah, I mean, I can see them going that way. They've been like, you know, there's been rumblings in that kind of direction, haven't there? And you have to have some sort of like security software there, or they could be demanding that kind of thing. So it seems that the right way to go in certain ways. But I don't like the idea of someone like PayPal controlling which browser I can use to connect to them. And yeah, hopefully it's just a trial that's going to go away. I hope the banks don't take this line.
Well, it depends, really. I mean, it might just be an easy way to enforce users to take a bit of ownership and responsibility for the security of the services that they connect to. You know, I don't think it's a bad idea.
They're also going to force them to upgrade and make sure they've got the latest patches on their operating system and other applications before they let them do the transactions.
That's what the Banking Association in New Zealand has done.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. I think that's taking it too far. But, you know, banning browsers that don't offer any sort of protection against phishing scams and things like that, you know, is really going to force people who use PayPal to upgrade to browsers that are more likely to prevent fraud on, you know, the PayPal service. So it seems to be a pretty shrewd and smart business decision that's really going to benefit users and PayPal themselves. So I don't really see it as being big bad PayPal, you know, kicking people around. I think it's a pretty good idea. As to their decision to only allow PayPal transactions in Australia, I mean, that's a whole other thing.
That's different. But even then, you put the two together and then it turns into, a bit controlling, really. I don't like that.
Zig hail PayPal.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah, okay. Now, in this other news story here, Microsoft has actually been blamed for a flaw in Google Docs.
This is really strange because it's not just Microsoft, it's not just Internet Explorer that's affected. But yeah, Google fixed the flaw in Google Docs. According to the story, it allowed an attacker to hijack sessions on any Google service. And but hang on, experts here say that the real damage is being caused by Internet Explorer, not Google's technology.
Well, it's kind of a bit of both. And that's actually our feature topic this week, is we're speaking to Jeremiah Grossman, who's a expert in all things web security. And you find that with all things cross-site scripting and, you know, cross-site request forgery and stuff like that, that, yeah, look, it can be fixed on the server side, but really the browsers shouldn't allow it in the first place. So this attack, you know, exploiting a flaw in Google, meant that people could basically, hijack a session. And of course, because Google users, you know, they have the same login and password pair for all of the different services like Google Docs and Google Analysis and, you know, and Analytics and all of that crap, that, it was a pretty serious thing for the Google users.
But it does affect Firefox as well. As far as I know, it does. It's not just Internet Explorer.
But let's bash Microsoft anyway. It's fine. But, dude, that's so 2002.
Yes, it is.
But, look, that's actually taken us to the end of the news, which was, okay. I'm sorry to the listeners, too, that it was really me just ranting about how crap the media is. But that's pretty much it for this week, Mun. So thank you very much. I believe you're off to India as well.
Oh, God, if only. Yeah, I was supposed to fly. It's a bit of a nightmare. Let's see what happens.
You were supposed to fly out today, weren't you? But you didn't get your visa?
Friday, but yes, the visa's a complete nightmare. It may still come. I may be on a plane tonight.
Okay, mate. Well, I hope to be speaking to you when you're jet-lagged next Monday.
Oh, yeah. You know that'll be a good show.
Okay, mate. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
ZDNet Australia's Mania Katadia there with this week's news. And it's time now for this week's feature interview. Jeremiah Grossman of White Hat Security in the United States is this week's special guest. As I mentioned in the intro, he was our first ever guest on this show, so it's always nice to have him back. And this week we're speaking to Jeremiah about cross-site request forgery, or CSRF for short. That's when you can trick a user's browser into performing an action it didn't intend through some sort of in-browser trickery. And while cross-site request forgery and cross-site scripting vulnerabilities have traditionally been regarded as quite trivial, the bad guys have flipped the script. CSRF is now being exploited in the wild with some fairly nasty results. Grossman spoke at the RSA conference on this, and he joined me by phone last week from the United Arab Emirates, where he was speaking at the Hack in the Box security conference.
Yep, that's the case. They figured out that the vulnerability is everywhere on every website that they come across with. And I think they're learning how to monetize with it, how to make money with it, and furthermore, how easy it is to pull off. So as the network gets more and more secure and other attack vectors are closed off, they'll seek the next easiest and most prolific target. And right now, that's cross-site request forgery.
And have you actually seen firsthand, this stuff being exploited in the wild?
We knew it was theoretically possible for many, many years, but everybody would downplay the severity of it for a variety of reasons. And in the last couple of months here, we've actually seen actual case studies of it being used maliciously in the wild.
Can you walk us through a couple of those case studies?
Sure. One of the more interesting ones that I found in a recent memory was a case study where the user would get sent a malicious e-greeting card in their email. The e-greeting card would have a special piece of malicious HTML, so that when the user opened the e-greeting card, from their perspective, when they open it in their browser, they're behind their firewall. They're behind their DSL router firewall, and their browser would be instructed to connect with the user's browser, would be connected to the DSL router to exploit the router and to update its DNS settings. And what the hack would do is, the next time you went to your Mexico bank, it was targeted at Mexico users, the DNS request would get funneled through the bad guy server. So instead of connecting to your web bank that you expected, you'd be communicating with the bad guy, and it was used for fraudulent purposes.
Wow, that's a pretty nasty attack. I mean, I got to say, though, still, like, if you're still relying on a user to actually open something, then it's really the same old tricks, isn't it, in a slightly different form?
Yeah, that exploit vector is used. It only required you to open the message, and then that the browser would take over from there. So the payload is what's unique in cross-site request forgery, not the method of attack. The other ways you can get infected or exploited by cross-site request forgery is on any website. It would have been trivial for the bad guy in this case, instead of targeting users by email, if they posted it to their MySpace profile or to a blog comment or to just any website anywhere in the world, the same effect would have taken place. So email is just the one they found most effective for this.
But it should be pointed out that someone would need to actually have an active login into that ADSL router and an open session in order for that to work, right?
If you wanted to ride the session, yes, that's absolutely correct. But in the case of this exploit, the bad guy forced the user to hack their own DSL router because it was known to be vulnerable. It was very easy to get administrative access on the machine, even though the user might not have been logged in and you might not know their password. So they're exploiting a well-known vulnerability on something on a DSL router. So normally you can't exploit it from the outside, but from the user's perspective, they are on the inside. So in this case, it was really effective.
Okay, so I guess what you're talking about there, I mean, is that just a bad default username and login username and password pair, or is that some sort of URL style vulnerability, and all I needed to do was to do a cross-site post to their ADSL router or something like that? How did that work?
So there's been a more recent case where it was attacking some AT&T DSL routers, and a lot of those do have default usernames and passwords, like admin for your username or your password, and no username or password, and that has happened. But in the case of the Mexico DSL routers, it was actually an exploit to get administrative access on the machine without the proper username and password. So it was an actual legitimate web-based interface exploit. So it works both ways. These devices aren't well tested because they don't have to be, because the general belief is that, well, they're inside the firewall. You have to be on site at the network to exploit these. But with the internet hacking tricks that are possible now in the browser, you can actually get the user to hack their own internet on your behalf.
Yeah, and I guess another thing that was interesting, I very nearly tracked you down to try to interview you about this. We've seen some serious stuff with cross-site scripting on a couple of fronts. One is with negative search engine optimization, in that you can actually use cross-site scripting vulnerabilities to punish people by presenting content to Google that looks like spam, that kills people through the rankings. And we've also seen this iframe embeds in cached search results when there's cross-site scripting bugs. So the bad guys do seem to have cottoned onto this all of a sudden, don't they?
Yeah, they've learned that it's instead of setting up their own website networks to try to boost Google, the Google rankings of their malicious web pages that way, they found they're starting to borrow the web security hacker tricks, and they're now just getting their stuff pseudo-hosted on the legitimate websites and getting the legitimate websites via cross-site scripting to link to them because it's much more effective. They call it Google Juice. It's much more effective to link a site that, you know, that already has a good ranking, you know, like a popular news site or a popular e-commerce site, to link to their malicious pages that way to boost their own rankings. It's incredibly effective because cross-site scripting is so pervasive out there. It's really easy to do.
Now, you've been jumping up and down and saying that cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery is a big deal. You've been saying this for a long time. Do you feel a little bit vindicated? I mean, are you almost relieved to see the bad guys doing stuff with this?
No, not at all. It's for those, the way I look at it is, you know, for those that want security, I jump up and down and say what I believe the new and emerging threats are. And those that follow my work will be at the same, that they'll have the information that they need to know to defend themselves. And, you know, so when we start seeing these, it is kind of that validation of our assumptions. They're not always right, of course, but we present things that we think are possible, that we think that it's coming, we think that they're emerging, and for those that want to take advantage of the information, that they can. But I'm not just exactly delighted about the fact that people are getting exploited out there, but it's the nature of the business. We have to point out the things that are going wrong or about to go wrong so we can kind of adjust it, but there will always be fallout no matter what.
Well, I guess the next question is, and the logical question is, where do we fix this? Is this something that's going to get fixed on the web server or in the browser, or both?
We actually have to fix it in both places. Right now, if you ask the average security expert, while we have recommended best practices out there, they're all but useless out there. The user really has no way to protect themselves against these online threats anymore. The browser security environment out there has gotten so weak fundamentally that there's really not a whole lot the user can do, besides maybe buy themselves a little bit of time with some quick tricks. Even the experts are really concerned about their own personal security online and taking some very extreme measures to protect themselves. But for the website owners, there's a lot that they can do, but it is a lot of work. It just takes the act of, you have to first find the vulnerabilities in your website, so you know, find the cross-site scripting and find the cross-site request of vulnerabilities in your site. That's the first step, and that's what Whitehead helps our customers do. And then secondly, once you know where the problem is, then you can go out the process of fixing it through a variety of means. You can fix it in the code. You can fix it with a web application firewall. You can secure it. You have lots of different ways to go about it, but it's that find and fix process that we need.
Can you just tell us if there are any implications for internet banking with cross-site request forgery? I mean, I imagine that older internet banking applications that don't rely on two-factor authentication would probably be vulnerable to cross-site request forgery attacks in which people could send some sort of post doing, you know, trying to pay money into accounts, things like that.
Those are the hot examples out there. When you want to demonstrate cross-site request forgery, you do it with a wire transfer process, where let's say the user wakes up one morning, logs into the bank account, does their business, and just forgets to log out, you know, normal user pattern out there. And they start visiting different websites, do some Google searches, stumble across some malware, and what have you. But they're still logged in, even though they're not on that particular banking website anymore. If they stumble across a site that exploits them with cross-site request forgery, the bad guy is making the user make an authenticated request, forcing them to wire transfer money out of their own account into the bad guy's account. To the website owner's perspective, it looks like a legitimate web request coming from a legitimate user with a legitimate action. Nothing is hacked about it. Everything looks real except the intent, and that's the difficulty for the site to do. And when you mentioned two-factor authentication, two-factor authentication is a security method that, should the user give up their password, you know, in some way, nobody else can use it without physical access to the token. But in the case of cross-site request forgery, the user is logged in. So it is not a valid security solution to prevent cross-site request forgery because it is the right user.
But that depends, Jeremiah, on how they've set it up. I mean, I know here in Australia, one of the banks requires either a SMS-based token or a hardware key fob token code every time you want to do something like add a new account to your account book, so you can't transfer money to an arbitrary account. So doesn't it, to a large degree, depend on implementation?
The transaction, you're saying.
I'm sorry?
they're validating the transaction, you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. They validate the transaction, not the login, because if they've just validated the login, then they'd have the problems that you're describing. And seriously, though, what sort of jackass bank lets you stay logged in when, you know, there's been no activity for a few minutes? Is that common?
At least the financial institutions we test, it's incredibly common.
Oh, my God.
And you also got to understand that just because the bank doesn't have it, you know, banking sites have password recovery. A lot of systems, financial institutions included, have password recovery systems where if you lost your password, they'll ask you to reset it via email. You're familiar with these systems, right?
Yeah, I just think that you wouldn't really see one of them in Australia being used on an internet banking site. I mean, that would be news.
Oh, yeah, then perhaps you have a better environment. I'll say straight up, I haven't tested a great deal of Australian-based.
I think we just got fished a lot harder earlier on, you know?
So you've already been battlefield tested.
Pretty much. Brazil and Australia were two of the hottest countries. We got majorly pwned in the early days because we had a very high uptake rate for internet banking. So, you know, if I'm on my bank and I stop doing stuff for 2 minutes, it logs me out. If I'm on there and, you know, I want to do anything new, it's going to require that I get some sort of token input, and, you know, it's pretty good. But I see where you're going with this, and I see why it's actually an issue now. How did the talk go down at RSA?
It was actually very well received. You know, it was just meant to bring light to a longstanding issue that not a lot of people knew the insides and outs in and outs of. They've heard of this issue, but really didn't know what it meant in a larger context. And it was just meant to be a walk through the landscape, what this is, how it works, some examples. And people were just appreciative of the simplicity of it and just making it simple for them to understand and how easy it was.
All righty. Well, look, that's all we're going to have time for today, Jeremiah. But thanks for coming on to Risky Business again. I believe you were actually our feature guest on the first episode. So I think this is this interview is going into episode 59. So there you go. It's been a while.
Fantastic. A lot of good work has been put on there. My congratulations. It's such a successful show.
Jeremiah Grossman there on the phone from the United Arab Emirates, where he was presenting at the Hack in the Box Security Conference in Dubai. Following that interview, Jeremiah pointed out to me in our conversation that webmail is a prime target for CSRF attacks because it's become the keys to the kingdom in many respects. When you request a password reset from many services these days, it usually relies on email validation. Spooky stuff. Now it's time for this week's sponsor interview. And this week's sponsor guest is a bit of a security legend. He's been high profile for Yonks and was an early pioneer in the field of intrusion detection systems. He wrote Dragon IDS back in the 90s before selling his company, Network Security Wizards, to Interesis Networks back in 2000. Interesis in turn owned by Cabletron then. Some time ago, he founded Tenable Network Security with Renaud de Raison, the creator of the open source Nessus security scanner, or as Renaud himself would call it, a vulnerability scanner, because he has the best French accent you've ever heard. Anyway, Tenable brought some controversy on itself back in 2005 when it brought out version 3.0 of Nessus under a non-GPL license. Nessus 2.0 remained out there as GPL code, and while open source nuts said they were going to improve it, it never really happened. You know, it sort of forked off, and you'll hear us discussing that a bit later. But all the Nessus-related publicity has sort of pigeonholed Tenable as a vulnerability scanning company. But these days, Tenable is also big in Security Information Event Management, or SIEM, or SIM, or whatever you want to call it. And we started off this week's sponsor interview by asking Ron why Tenable has jumped into SIM.
So about a year after we released our management console, which was performing vulnerability scanning, we got some requests to do correlation with intrusion detection systems. You know, I still had a lot of Dragon customers out there, a lot of Snort users and different things like that. But what we really wanted to do was focus on if I am attacked and I am vulnerable, page me, email me, do something interesting. And what we developed was per port correlation rules that users really didn't have to mess with. Once they turned the system on, if they had Nessus scanning every day and if they had their IDSs being updated every day, they would receive automatic notification. Even if a plus one 0-day attack, you know, came out, they would know that they've been attacked and probably successfully compromised.
I got to ask too. We had Greg Shipley on the show a few weeks ago, and he was talking about SIM. And said that he's seen some very interesting products out there that take logs from non-security applications. So they'll take logs from things like CRM apps and wrap them into the same console and give you some real meaningful security intel. Are you guys looking to do similar sorts of things with your platform?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, SIEM means so many things to so many different people. What I describe with vulnerability IDS correlation is really just one feature in the whole event space of SIEM. Now, what's interesting is if you can take logs from an application CRM, that might be hosting very important, business information, and even if you can abstract very simple information such as login events, failure events, and maybe change events, people who've inserted data, people who've removed data, if you can correlate that with maybe an external penetration to your network, an after-hours user who's making these changes, or just maybe even correlating where these events are originating from geographically, there's a huge amount of business intelligence that can be gained from doing that. Now, the danger is, if you don't understand how your applications normally run, the first time that you get these kind of events, people tend to freak out. And that's what we try to say, hey, it's very important to get back to scanning and know what's on your network, know how it's configured, so you know who's using your network and causing these login events in the first place.
Now, you attracted some controversy when you closed off Nessus. Of course, Tenable used to maintain it, and you closed it off. That was a few years ago now. What's happened to the open source stream? Because you basically forked it, didn't you, into a commercial Nessus and a open source Nessus?
Well, what we did is there's really two pieces of Nessus. There's the actual scanning engine, and then there's the actual plugin that updates. So on Microsoft Tuesday, the folks at Tenable and our research group, they do all of the analysis required to update Nessus. So even if you go back to the open source days, so to speak, when we had Nessus 2, there was really two different pieces of intellectual property, the scanning engine and the plugin updates. All we've really done is said, hey, the scanning engine, it's still Nessus 2, and that source code's still out there, definitely available for anybody to download, modify, submit back to Tenable, whatever they want. But what we did is we wrote an independent new scanning engine that was compatible with Nessus, and this is something that we wanted to close source because it allowed us to build in a lot of other very, very interesting features that, the amount of research and effort we had to put in to the product was not something that we were prepared to just simply put the source code out there because it really wasn't a two-way street. We weren't getting a whole lot of feedback from users. And even if you go back about 3 or 4 years ago, we were getting a lot of companies who literally did not want to purchase open source products. They would almost go on the lawyers and different parts of the organization were actually ruled they couldn't buy open source products. So it was actually hurting the Tenable business, so to speak.
I think we spoke about that a few years ago, and you were saying that it was really an issue of getting around certain organizations' procurement processes.
It still comes up, and we try not to be we definitely try to be very, very pro free tools to the community. I mean, if you go to the either our blog or the Nessus.org website, you'll see that we actually have more tools up there than just Nessus at this point. We've written a variety of tools to work with the Ida Pro executable analyzer. We've written some tools that allow people to perform SMB types of analysis. And added a lot of functionality to Nessus itself. And all those plugins that have gone into Nessus, although they might not be distributed under a GPL license, the source code's still there for people to look at. So you're talking about 20,000 different types of vulnerability audit algorithms that anybody can look at, and if they want to modify, submit back to us, they can absolutely do that. So we have more Nessus users now than ever before, and Tenable's in a very, very good spot to keep maintaining Nessus and to keep doing that. You said before about competing with Symantec and CA and whatnot. We had to do this in order to compete with those kind of folks because we simply were not getting the type of input into the research and development to keep the Nessus relevant, for the 21st century.
Well, the Nessus 2.0 engine, which is the one that remained open source and GPL, that one hasn't seen much action since, has it? I mean, the whole open source community that was very, passionate about continuing to maintain it seemed to sort of evaporate.
The answer there is, we've submitted a variety of fixes for it. There was some, we've considered end of lifing certain types of branches of the Nessus 2 tree simply because the number of Nessus plugins has grown. And, you know, the old code wasn't intended to handle things like plugin IDs, you know, larger than 30,000 and things like that. But more interestingly, one of the things that we're worried about is that we've gotten some emails recently of people saying that, you know, Nessus 2 is faster than Nessus 3. And what it is there's a variety of open source packages out there who kind of put Nessus 2 source code in that, and a very, very small number of plugins, maybe 2,000, 3,000 plugins, all the ones that were distributed under the GPL feed. And what happens is people run these plugins, and guess what? It runs really fast, but they're only running with a couple thousand plugins versus, you know, for free what somebody could get with Nessus 3, 20,000 plus. So there's a big difference in the comprehensiveness of the audit.
And there hasn't been much development on the engine itself, has there? I mean, outside of what you guys have done.
Outside of Nessus 2, outside of what we've done to maintain it, most of the action has really been on the client side. There's been a number of folks who've released new clients, and these work with Nessus 3 just as well as Nessus 2. We are very at Tenable, we're very focused on the new Nessus client that we've released recently. But one of the things we've done in the past is Tenable sort of got involved in supporting other people's clients. The Nessus WX client was something that was very popular for a long time. And a lot of people didn't realize that although Tenable didn't write it, we ended up maintaining it and fixing bugs in it for the last 2 or 3 years.
Well, Ron Gula, thank you very much for coming on to Risky Business.
Hey, Tenable is looking forward to the great things happening on Risky Business. We've been a fan of your previous episodes, and we're thrilled to be included going forward.
Strange, I've seen that face before. Ron Gula on the line there from the USA, wrapping up this week's podcast. This week's Sound Foundation track is Libertango, performed by Glass. If you're old enough, you'll remember the Grace Jones version from the 80s. What a classic. And you can buy this version from soundfoundation.com.au for $1.40. And I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Waiting for the day. Shadows me back home. Footsteps echo on the stone. The rainy nights, the hustling boulevards, and the music drifting from the bars. Drinks, bars and restaurants. Home with anyone who wants. Strange, I see you sitting. Waiting for the day.
side.